Hi, this is Steve Gilmore, and this is the Gilmore Gang. This will be an abbreviated edition today, for various reasons. And we're going to have to let you imagine a picture of Yuri Engström, who's joining us from, I believe, Finland. Right, Yuri?
That's right.
Okay. Because we haven't got one, and we're going to... There's a little one here. Why don't you just... Yeah. Okay, that's great. So... welcome, Yuri.
Thanks.
Also joining us from God knows where is Robert Scoble.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of Mervyn's, which is now known as the Rackspace Castle, which is the headquarters of Rackspace. But here I'm standing in front of the world's largest word search. So we'll go down and look at that a little later.
Okay. Also joining us from, I guess, Ribbit headquarters. Is that correct, Kevin Marks?
That's right, yes.
And from Tashek headquarters, a legend in his own mind, John Tashek. Welcome, John.
Good to be here, Steve. Thanks.
Let's get you a picture of you up. There you go. Say it again.
Good to be here, Steve. Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay, some interesting things have happened this week, and a whole bunch of rumors about things that probably aren't going to happen. And I want to start with that one. Microsoft buying Adobe. Anybody heard anything about that?
Lots of rumors.
That's it?
You were always talking about this when you were at Microsoft, Robert. You always were jealous of Adobe.
What? No, I was jealous of Apple. No, there's actually entire teams at Microsoft that are trying to crush Adobe, right? You know, the Silverlight team was formed because Flash got so popular, and they were worried that Flash was going to become a platform that could, you know, hurt Microsoft in some way.
Right. So So do you believe that they're liable to merge? Is that something that's likely to happen, or do you think the ego is too big?
I wonder if it's going to get approved by, you know, by the people who approve antitrust.
Well, I mean,
it certainly takes a major competitor off the floor, right?
A major competitor for what?
First of all,
merging.
A bunch of things.
Who's going to merge? Microsoft's going to merge with Adobe? I don't get that. That's like
the
tools team would love to have Microsoft Photoshop and Illustrator customers. They've been trying to figure out how to get designers to use Microsoft stuff for years, and this would get them right into the family. And
you mean
just
about the time that software disappears, they're going to get Photoshop?
No, software's not going to disappear anytime soon. I mean, Visual Studio is still a major product, right? And by having designers and developers together, that just makes Visual Studio stronger. I can see the strategic reasons for joining these companies pretty deeply.
John, Tashek?
Yeah, I mean, the names that people are banding around, Microbi and AdoboSoft or whatever.
Sounds about right, a virus in the form of Flash.
You know, they compete on Silverlight, as Robert said, and Flash. But I don't know. I think the future is moving a lot more toward mobile, and Adobe doesn't have a good story there. And Microsoft's launch next week, or what is it, Monday? Who knows what that's going to meet up with? I don't see what Adobe really gets them, except it gets them the if they could combine the web dev stuff that Adobe has, that Adobe actually acquired itself. They have a full suite of development tools, but again, it's development tools for the desktop. And sure, if you want to lock in, that's great. But I don't know. It doesn't really make sense to me. Google buying Adobe makes more sense because of their partnerships recently.
Okay. Well, I think the only thing that makes sense about it would be for them to download Silverlight onto every Flash runtime on the network. Other than that, I mean, who needs it?
Designers still use, you know, this word search was built in Adobe Illustrator, I'm sure. You know, there's still a lot of people who use Adobe products. They still make millions of dollars in revenue.
That's fine. I mean, you know.
It's like Oracle buying companies for their maintenance stream. That's what Microsoft would buy Adobe because they have that installed base on the development tools on Illustrator, Photoshop, and they would be a competitor to Apple, right? That's why they would do it. But it seems like Apple's eating their lunch on Final Cut, Adobe's lunch on Final Cut. I'm not sure Apple has too much strength in development tools on anywhere else, but they would have that. I don't know. I think it would pass the FTC antitrust. I just don't think that it gets Microsoft anything. I don't think it's going to increase shareholder value. I think the companies operate separately better. That's my take on it.
Right. I mean, I think it seems like it would be a move against Apple and possibly Google. It almost seems like an acquisition to be made just to keep someone else from having Adobe. And also, like, what would happen to Silverlight? I mean, that's like the question mark for me in that whole equation. Like, what's going to happen in the Flash Silverlight? Like, you know, is Silverlight just going to disappear, or you know, what would happen?
Which team would kill which team? Because both teams would not survive.
Yeah.
And I think we're talking about mobile, Flash at least has distribution on most of the mobile platforms out there other than the iPhone. So I would say Flash
is barely there at all.
They're barely there. They have nothing that actually works on any platform.
Well, no, you know,
that's not true.
Got it on some of my phones, but it's only the brand new ones and doesn't work that well. Yeah, not there yet.
Well, I mean, Silverlight's not there yet either, if you want to say it.
No, I'm not saying it is. Yeah.
I mean, you know, Silverlight's not there yet on the iPhone in the same way that Flash is not there yet.
So maybe what they would do is call the Silverlight team the Flash, call it Flash, push Silverlight to everybody's phones, and except for the iPhone.
That's what I said about 10 minutes ago. All right, so I'm right.
I mean, the Windows Mobile Phone 7 coming out Monday is going to have Silverlight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what else? That's
and
about
Flash,
it.
Flash, too.
Really?
That's the rumors. I don't know. I don't have one of these phones yet.
Well, if you don't have one, they don't exist.
I had dinner with a Microsoft executive, and he didn't have one yet, and he said he had to wait 6 weeks for him to get it.
So. Okay, so this sounds like a January release, too. I don't think they're ready yet.
We'll see.
Yeah,
chat room wants to talk about Evan stepping down as Twitter CEO. That might actually be more interesting than talk about Microsoft.
Well, not to me. I think that the idea that that there's an asset that Adobe has that's worth buying is fascinating. It shows, I think, how desperate Microsoft's become.
I think so too. I think the reason we're struggling with this is because we can't see the vision of the two companies as a merged company, and or even an acquired company. It doesn't strike us as visionary or innovative or anything except a defensive maneuver, and that's why we're kind of struggling with the question altogether.
Well, I mean, the piece that sort of kind of fits together is document formats. So Microsoft has the de facto closed standard with Word, with .doc, and Adobe has a de facto semi-open standard with PDF. If they could pull those together, that might give them some ability to sort of hold the line against HTML becoming the universal document format for a bit.
Yeah, except I think that
it may be a bit late for that. That's probably about 5 years too late for that.
Not only that, but I think that the real strategy is to absorb Flash, you know, merge Silverlight with Flash, call it Flash, or eventually call it Silverlight.
Flashlight, yeah.
Yeah, well, I like that. LITE, right, or Flash Heavy. And then merge both of those into HTML5 and be done with the whole problem. Because, you know, Microsoft doesn't need to spam every container on the planet. For their business model. They've got a business model right now. Yeah. So I think this is an HTML5 gambit, and I think it's a smart one, and I just hope that we can drive down the price of Adobe stock to the point where Microsoft can can gobble it without, you know, serious indigestion. All right, Robert, where are you?
I'm just walking around. I'm going to go and show you the big-ass fan that we have.
Robert, what does Mervyn's and Rackspace have to do with each other?
Rackspace bought an old shopping mall and turned it into their headquarters, and we're in about one-tenth of the mall right now, which used to be the old Mervyn's department store. And here's our big-ass fan, which actually is the brand name on this fan is Big-Ass Fan, which is funny. It's a big-ass fan. That's exactly what it is. And so this used to be the Mervyn's shopping mall or the Mervyn's store, and they put, you know, a few hundred people in here, and they're taking over slowly the rest of the mall, which you can sort of see outside the window there.
Yeah, nice. I see people walking up the stairs there.
Yeah, we have 3,000 employees here, so lots of people working here.
Right.
So what are you doing in Texas?
I spoke at the SAS event yesterday and judged a bunch of startups. Everybody's trying to figure out what startups are doing. And then tonight we're going to have a tweet up and have a party.
So SAS,
but today I've just been meeting with my bosses and making sure they still like us. Actually, we have some news coming out in a couple, so I filmed some videos for that as well.
SAS stands for No Software as a Service?
Software as a Service, yeah.
I see. Okay. Yuri, what are you doing?
Right now?
Well, just in general. You know, sort of a what? Say it again.
I am working on a new startup right now.
And what is it?
The name of the company is Pingpin, but I'm still trying to figure out what to call it. So actually, I might solicit listeners for good name suggestions.
But you have to say what it is first.
It's a mobile app for doing, basically, I'm combining mobile push notifications with some structured data to make it very easy and check-in-like to say what you're, or basically solicit people for ideas for what to do in the next 30 minutes. So it's like you just say, oh, I'm heading out to eat, but
hey guys,
I may not know which restaurant I end up at.
Uh-huh. There's Rob Legess, by the way.
So
it's like the Beatles cover.
I need like the video so badly here. I'm totally missing out.
Sorry.
Oh, what? Describe what we would have seen if we had a camera. Yuri.
So talking about the app that I'm building, it's basically you say where you're going, and people can respond with suggestions about where you should end up. If you're going out to eat, then your friends can get a push notification and then respond to you with suggestions about good places nearby.
Sorry about that.
And applying that same idea for different things like books and movies and stuff like that.
So it's like shouting out to Twitter saying, where should I eat in Palo Alto, but moved into a specific app?
Yeah, basically.
Okay,
I used to do that. Actually, that was one of the useful features of Jaiku, was
right.
Being able to say, hey, I'm just heading out to breakfast or lunch or dinner or whatever, and then having just people respond with, oh, you should check this place out, or can I join you? Just having these threads, or on Twitter, they're not really threads, but, you know, at replies, and just making that very easy, because on Twitter, I find it just spams my followers. Most of them don't want to hear about local stuff, local coordination. There's a lot of at replies that don't really make any sense. So it seems useful to just put that into an app and have the conversations happen on a different channel.
Is it using Twitter as a back end for it, or are you creating your own infrastructure for this?
Oh, I'm just building it as a Google App Engine app right now. I'm, you know, basically using my own back end for it. You can share it on Twitter, obviously, or Facebook. You can syndicate it out to those, but it's not using Twitter as a back end.
And it has location-based services. It's kind of intentional check-in or actionable check-in. You're going to check into somewhere in 30 minutes. You don't know exactly where, but you're looking for advice, and then you kind of check in at the same time?
Well, yeah, you just tap a button and say, like, oh, I'm heading out to eat, or another button. I'm just playing around with different buttons. One of them is, like, oh, I want to do something with my kids. And then that just gets pushed to the people who are interested in that update that are maybe nearby. And then they can choose to view the message. And then I'm using, actually, things like Foursquare to improve the auto-suggestions you get, so that you can, if you say, oh, I'm heading out to eat, and you're in San Francisco, and right now I am in Helsinki, I can still get that push notification, and when I respond to it, I will see the locations nearby you that I have checked into often.
Oh,
this way I can easily just tap a recommendation to you, like, oh, you should check out Blue Bottle, which is right nearby where you are, because that's my favorite coffee shop, although I may not be in the area.
And you're aiming at the consumers with this.
Yeah, it's just a quick way to say, here's what I'm going to do, and then sort of engage your friends in a conversation about that. That may end up in you doing something together or just a suggestion. You can also send back a little thanks, like a little trophy that then gives the other person more karma points, saying, oh, that was a great suggestion. Thanks for that.
Do you think there's a room in this space for doing that kind of stuff with Foursquare and Gowalla and Whirl and Brightkite and Looped already doing similar kinds of things?
Yeah, I think, none of them really fixes this problem. And it was the most useful aspect of microblogging for me personally, I think, was like just being able to do this local coordination if I thought of what value I really get out of it. I'd love for things like Foursquare to do that. I think they're almost doing it with tips, but
yes.
The idea here is you can actually engage your friends in real time, which you can't really respond to check-ins right now.
Yeah, I've felt that in recent days. I've noticed that the three people that I follow on Foursquare, that I see them and I see where they, that's interesting. Gee, if I could just, like, IM them or something, and then boom, I'm gone. I'm gone to another app or forget about it. I mean, why don't they open up Presence? Seems, isn't that what this is?
Well, it's available for the API, I just haven't exposed it. I've used other Foursquare clients that will tell me how many people are at a certain location and stuff.
Yeah, but I'm talking about a chat back end.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they've only got shouts, which doesn't quite do that. That's true. The tips are starting to be more surfaced a bit more, which was the thing that was quite interesting about Foursquare when they first did it.
The other thing about the sort of economics behind checking into a place and being able to essentially barter with a company for, oh, that's interesting, well, but this store across the street, they're telling me I can get the same thing for 10% more off. And then if you can have that, then why not have a conversation between the two stores, and you can sit back and let them negotiate themselves down to while you go and have a cup of coffee at some other place. I mean, go ahead.
The idea makes a lot of sense. I tend to get those offers or deals on things like Foursquare when I'm already checked into a location. So I'm like at a restaurant, I've checked in, I'm maybe just about to order, and then it says, oh, there's a deal across the street. Like, what are the chances that I'm actually going to walk over the street to the other restaurant at that point? They're usually pretty low. So personally, for me, it's interesting to try to think about ways to, basically, this is about intent. You may not know where you're going to end up yet, and this seems like a better place to provide you with suggestions, both from your social network and possibly also from, merchants around you that have a deal to offer.
Well, I just was back from Japan, which is why I'm so disorganized. It's my excuse for why I'm so disorganized today. And FaceTime is amazing over once you get outside the United States. I was able to basically, dial in on FaceTime, put the iPod Touch down, work with the iPad or do anything else, and it's basically like sitting next to somebody in the room. Like Tina's right here, and the other night I was basically just listening to my daughter fall asleep the way that I do when I'm here. I mean, it becomes a replacement. So here's my point. The yesterday when I was at the airport in Tokyo, Tina was on the move around San Francisco, and she went from one location that had Wi-Fi to another location that had Wi-Fi. And, you know, all of a sudden there she is, popped up. You know, the value proposition for the economy, of the Wi-Fi economy, is, I think, going to become extremely significant. Because once you get into this kind of a real-time interactive environment over Wi-Fi, first of all, the costs are zero. And the improvement over the, it's like the difference between instant messaging or collaboration technologies and email, only with voice. It's like voice and picture. But even if it's just the voice, the fact that it has such a proximity effect and that it goes across time zones as well as, you know, location, it neutralizes the notion of location in a very powerful way. So that's when these kinds of things, you know, I start seeing these alerts and these check-ins from Foursquare coming up on my iPhone when I'm in Tokyo. It's not exactly relevant to me, but if there were a group of people who were sort of bonded together, perhaps using this new Facebook group technology across, you know, a virtual place, and start to have these kinds of conversations. I mean, it really is irrelevant where you are if you're invited into a conversation that's going on in virtual space. It just seems like the dawn of something that's much bigger than I think we've realized until now.
No, I think that's right. I think that's, you know, to some extent that's what I've been thinking about here at BT, trying to visualize the future of telecommunications, and the fact that we're starting to see ubiquitous Wi-Fi where we don't care about bandwidth and paying, you know, by the minute to a carrier makes a big difference about what you can do with it and what becomes interesting. So the kind of thing we're doing now, having this sort of video chat from five locations, bringing that down to the device you're carrying in your pocket, and being able to carry that, you know, bridge that everywhere and not worry about what kind of thing you're calling, becomes really interesting. And that's that, you know, there's some work to be done there to try and converge some of the stuff that we're doing here to get it to actually interoperate rather than all being baked into Skype or something, but it's getting a lot closer. And that was something I got from Ohm's Mobilize last week as well, seeing several people who are starting to build, you know, video calling stuff between devices as well.
And one other data point, which was, we just lost Robert. One other data point was at the airport, when I came in to Tokyo Airport, I didn't know that there wasn't any Wi-Fi available, so I was kind of out of touch and had a couple of calls with people that I did landline, which cost like $30 or so, as opposed to being free over Wi-Fi. But when I left, I walked around the airport for a few minutes, and there was a broadband cafe which offered power receptacles, computers for people who didn't have a device, etc., etc., and most particularly free Wi-Fi. And, you know, I didn't even have to buy anything. I mean, I did out of gratefulness, but it was as soon as you, these kinds of businesses, they have a business model. If you extrapolate that to any business, as long as you can walk in and out of it, it's kind of like the you know, air miles clubs, where, you know, they encourage you to re-enter by, you know, and the way that the iPhone and these devices work in terms of picking up the existing credentials and doing a handoff that's seamless, it's the more that we can find Wi-Fi available zones as we move around,
right.
You know, we're going to establish a you know, kind of a campus kind of footprint. It just seems to be that this is going to drive a lot of things a lot quicker than might be realized right now.
Right. So something.
I'm still on an iPhone, partly because of FaceTime. Yeah. But like the minute Google does Google Talk with video for Android, I am so sold on Android. Because right now, I get super annoyed by the limitations of Facebook. Like, I can't call people who have a freaking, you know, whatever, iChat on their desktops, and, you know, I just can't call them on FaceTime. You know, but, you know, thinking about, like, a universal Gtalk video to your phone is just insanely cool.
It's insanely cool, but you're each one of the negotiations with the carriers on the Android platform, as it destabilizes their revenue over POTS and text messaging, is going to be a separate, you know, crisis that's going to take quite a while to unsort. And Apple has the advantage of what they continue to do, which is when they see another platform getting close to those kinds of technologies, they unbundle. The second that Android starts to have that capability in any large, ubiquitous, cross Android platform, if you understand what I'm saying, Apple will move aggressively toward working with carriers that will support using these things over the 3G and 4G networks. And the same thing is going to be true, I think, of you know, they've already committed to, at some future date, which is probably a week before Android is capable of doing it, unbundling iSight or connecting iSight and FaceTime. So, you know, I just don't see this as some sort of hard-coded target, and I agree with you that...
It's a question of getting stuff to actually interoperate, which the lower level is all there. You know, everyone's using the same codecs and the same protocols pretty much, just... getting the actual plumbing so that we can actually call between systems is what we need. And I definitely see that coming.
Deary?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that would be the ideal world, right? And, you know, I'm just kind of waiting for... I'm saying, like, Google Talk is already becoming so ubiquitous in my social network. You know, okay, granted, almost everybody has iPhones. They just don't have iPhone 4 maybe yet. But, you know, I'm thinking, like, I really like idea of being able to call the desktop and, you know, like, have stuff even that runs in the browser like the Google Video stuff does. So, I don't know, that to me just seems like this holy grail, and I'm just waiting for Google to do it. I've been waiting for them to do it since they launched video on Gtalk, because it just seems like such an obvious selling point for Android.
Well, it also pushing that into the HTML standardization process as well. At the moment, to do that kind of stuff, you basically just sit there on Flash or write a client app. So pushing that into that device stuff into the HTML piece is the next layer, which will be coming in the next couple of years. We're starting to see bits of that already. On the ubiquitous Wi-Fi thing, one piece of that, something BT launched a couple of weeks ago in the UK, is, I don't know if you know this, but the way the BT sells home Wi-Fi in the UK is they have the FON, F-O-N stuff in there, which means that every base station is also available for sharing to other customers. And they launched an app for both Android and iPhone that automatically signs you in when it sees one. So the situation you had, Steve, would mean if you're in the UK, every time you pass someone's house or office that had a BT base station in you, and you were a BT customer, you would be connected to that network.
Well, as a matter of fact, on the bus that I took to the airport, it had a big sign that said it was Wi-Fi.
Right.
And the Wi-Fi was available, I believe, through FON, through phone.
Right.
FON.
Yeah.
Is it phone or FON?
I say FON, but because phone is really confusing, but who knows? It's
so,
Spanish.
Yeah, so. But I think that the... I continue to believe that Apple has the advantage in this situation, because they can essentially set up an economic network that will continue to grow as other people try and copy it. So I'm glad I've got an iPhone 4 instead of waiting for another 2 years to get what I'm capable of doing right now. I know my daughter appreciates it, that, you know, it was an investment that promptly backfired when my other daughter lost or had her iPhone 4 stolen. But she wasn't using it to call me because she doesn't really want to talk to me anyway.
Well, the thing is, you can use the Touch now as well. That's the other thing. You know,
the iPod Touch is just phenomenal.
Yeah, no, I've got it here, and it is a lovely thing. It's tiny, lovely screen, very, very impressive.
John Toshek, what do you think? I know what you think, but now you can tell everybody.
So I should mix it up a little bit, so you
don't
really
can pretend
know
that
think.
You don't think what you think, and then you know you argue with yourself, or you can just tell us what you think.
Yeah, that's true. I do argue with myself. That's how I get things done. So the iPod Touch, yeah, it is cool. Of course, I don't use any of the FaceTime stuff. But I think it would be really interesting I think the market would benefit. I think Apple's going to drive the market through its marketing of FaceTime for video. I think all these other companies like Yahoo just announced something today that they're going to do something. I'm sure Microsoft will have video. And if you put it something on the Android platform, we'll have four competing frameworks that all support video. And that will eventually drive the market, just like how there was ICQ at one time and Yahoo Messenger and...
well, that's not the best conversion story. That took about 10 years.
It was a terrible one, but it's going to happen the same way, maybe a little bit faster. Maybe it'll take 5 years. I still think video is good in certain circumstances, like for family and for certain kinds of conversations and things like that. I just don't see it a huge hockey stick yet. I think it's a year away or so away. Maybe I'm off on that.
Yeah, I think you're off on that.
Okay. Well,
here's why I think you're off on it. The personal dynamics, as I know Salesforce, among other companies, is betting on, how they move into the enterprise. They move much more rapidly than people commonly realize or even think about or care about. And, when you talk about eyesight, for example, or video conferencing on a laptop machine, except for Scoble, of course, who does everything first and in greater numbers than anybody else does, it's not easy to carry a laptop around without inviting conversation. I mean, if you carried a laptop at the airport around and did this, you would be arrested because you were casing the joint. But people do not argue with or even think twice about the fact that you're sitting there with this iPhone or an iPod Touch, that you're talking to somebody around the world in real time.
Yeah.
Also, you can move with it. It becomes a device that, instead of saying, well, let me describe for you what it is, you just turn the camera. You push the button and the image flips. And suddenly, not only are you being transmitted, but your location is being transmitted and the feeling of what you're seeing and what's going on there. Now, to think that that's not going to have applications for business use. The other thing about Japan that was interesting, many things were interesting, but specifically was I'll probably get the terminology wrong because I couldn't quite understand it. That's very nice.
I was thinking of riding around.
Are you going to do it?
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing that was interesting is that in Japan, they have a Galapagos phone. John, do you know anything about this?
I don't.
Okay. I think it's a sort of derogatory term for the fact that the platform for 3G has been built out for 7 or 8 years in Japan. They're way ahead of us. I think there's a 90% penetration of 3G in that market as opposed to about 30% over here. And so it's kind of like the French system. What was that? The computer terminal?
Minitel?
Minitel?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was way ahead, and now it was so far ahead that now it's not a standard. It, therefore, it's way behind. So... That's cool, Robert.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun.
So the Minitel, I'm sorry, the Galapagos. I apologize to everybody for this. Phones, among other things, I noticed when I went in a store to do some quick shopping before I left, and people have their phones open, these types of phones, and they're using it to scan barcodes or whatever the kind of indication is on products, and if they see what the price is and see what a comparative price, they're into e-commerce so far ahead of us is not funny. So if you if you abstract that,
whoa,
yes, this is a look inside the adult mind of Robert Scoble. Accelerating tiny shiny objects at every second. Okay, Robert, where are you?
I'm in the Rackspace. Hey.
Did you just wreck?
Yeah.
He had a Wi-Fi crash. Anyway, do you see what I'm saying, Kevin? There's this.
There's this assumption that it's something you socially it's something you carry around with you, which is, you know, I suppose that's kind of, you know, you can see that if you wander around the right bits of San Francisco, but it's not mainstream here in the same way it isn't in Japan.
And so it's and just from a, as John was talking about or we were disagreeing about, as a video device, certainly it has limitations in terms of its adoption, but as a video slash e-commerce device slash location meeting negotiator, the kind of thing where you can sit down wherever you are if you're in Wi-Fi range and join a conversation, as there are bridges that let you tap into social networks behind the firewall, that's going to happen momentarily.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to drive this technology, and it'll also, as I think Yuri and all of us here are suggesting, it's going to drive the adoption of compatible standards across all these devices very rapidly. Do you agree with that, John?
I think there's about 300 million people in the United States, and say 250 million are above age 10, and there's probably about a few million using FaceTime now. And depends on what you mean by hockey stick. So if it goes to 20 million, is that a hockey stick for you? Yeah, sure. It'll go
if
to
they,
20 million.
If they all have discretionary buying power that is at the top of you know, their market, yeah, absolutely. I think that's enormous. I mean, what are we talking about here in terms of corporate use? It's going to go through the roof very rapidly.
Yeah, and then enterprise sales channel, you know, you'd want this to happen. I think it's going to take a little bit longer. I think in the customer service world, where you're right now, there's chat on a lot. Chat's just coming into a lot of companies, and these companies have outsourced their call centers to different places. They maybe don't want those people to be on video, so your video connections to customer service aren't there. I think this is something that's going to come later, and I do see a large penetration here, but it's going to be a while before. It's got an enterprise value. That's not saying I'm not looking forward to it. I think it will be really good. I just think that the way people work here in the United States, or maybe we're a little bit behind. Infrastructure-wise, we're a little behind. The way that we use certain functionality, we're a little bit behind. But that doesn't mean that we're laggards either. We're just kind of like, you know, we're in the middle.
Well, I certainly agree with most of what you're saying about being conservative about the time frame. On the other hand, what is Microsoft going to do if not push this envelope? I mean, this whole the ability to be able to control your games and stuff. What's the name of that new product that they're selling?
I know nothing of Microsoft. I don't know what they sell.
Oh, God.
You know, they...
Kinect, something like that.
Yeah, Kinect.
Kinect?
Yeah.
No? Is that right?
Whatever it's called.
I know what you mean. The one you stand in front of the screen and dance in it.
Right, so that's an input device. It's not a big stretch to go from there to adopting that technology for e-commerce and for putting people into a negotiation mode inside of on the move and... You know, combining these devices that you use to go through bridge tolls, et cetera, mm-hmm. as those all become part of a smartphone experience, the ability for even third parties, in fact, especially third parties, to come in and basically connect and offer bargains across, you know, becoming middlemen for negotiating prices as people are on the go. I think that's going to be huge.
Be good. What do you think about Cisco's home entry? I guess it's a home level, you know, it's not personal, but more of a home video conferencing option that does the telepresence in the home. Is that just like?
It sounds wildly expensive. I mean, you know, I mean, why?
Well, $400 or something like that.
I think it's $600, first of all. And I think it requires a $24 a month or $25 a month, retainer in terms of the infrastructure. I think it's going to cannibalize their larger boxes. So, you know, if they push that out to whatever that marketplace is. Robert, you famously went to that telepresence thing, and does that seem like a growing market for you, or are they sort of stuck at the high end? I can't hear you.
It's going to be hard to justify anybody buying this. I mean, we're already doing video conferencing with Skype. Look at this call, right? This didn't cost me $600 additional to add on to my MacBook.
Yeah, but you know the limitations of Skype in a business setting, I think, are fairly substantial or be used more. I mean,
but there's lots of companies out there that are using Skype-like things to do video conferencing for far less money, or at least for far less initial money. You know, they do a monthly fee kind of thing.
Yuri, what do you think? Do you think that?
I think there's two points here. Like that, first of all, this is a classic disruptive. Kind of like a market disruption going on with video here. With that started with Skype early on, and it's been, you know, surprisingly long in the coming, just because, like, I don't think Skype video calling has caught on as quickly as I would have thought it would originally when this came out. But really, I mean, what's going on here is that, you know, video calling is becoming ubiquitous, it's becoming mobile, and it's becoming free or close to free, and that's just bad news for anybody who's up at the top of the food chain with really, really high-end offerings trying to sell those to corporations, and we're just going to see those people, you know, their lunch slowly being eaten out from underneath them, and there's nothing they can do about it, really, and that's kind of my sense of what's going on, frankly, with the whole Cisco deal. Second point, you know, just from like a sociologist background here is like, I wonder when we get ubiquitous video calling on mobile devices. Like, is that, you know, I don't know how you guys, you know, envision this going to happen, but, you know, is it going to be uncomfortable for somebody to say, well, could we just do voice because I really don't want to show you my face right now? You know, how are the social norms going to play out around this? Is there going to be an expectation that, you know, you should be on a video call every time, or, you know, how's that going to play out?
Well, my experience with that is, the way I gauge that, well, first of all, Tashek, for example, he's just meeting phobic to begin with. So, you know, there's certainly, you don't want to have to go and get dressed in order to have a phone conversation with somebody.
Exactly.
But the other measure that I have of this is my almost 10-year-old daughter, she's fascinated by this, number one. Number two, every time she is on a call, a video call with me, she spends the first few minutes going like, and making faces at the camera and going, you know, exactly like Skull.
It's kind of like you.
No, it's like kind of like Skull. That's what it's like.
It is exactly.
Exactly.
Like
who are you? But eventually,
so driving around in it.
Eventually, and Robert is the rule that is the exception. Is that eventually you get tired of that. And you start, it's like the fourth wall in comedy or drama, where it recedes into the background and you forget that it's there. The suspension of belief in film, you start caring about the people, even though they're artificially constructed and aren't real. So I think that as we get used to it, it's like the way we've gotten used to the latency of cell phones. One of the reasons that this conversation works on video is because we're so used to an average latency on cell phones of any conversation. Since most, you know, landlines are gone, we're used to a certain kind of delay, and we've learned how to accommodate it. So I think that we will rapidly do the same with video. Robert, go ahead.
No, I agree. If you go to Simple Geo's office in Boulder, Colorado, they have an LCD monitor up on the wall that's always on and is using iChat to show their San Francisco office. And they find that it's, even by just using it as a window into the San Francisco office, it lets people see, oh, the office is busy or it's not busy or nobody, the person you want to call isn't there. You know, it just, it's nice to feel connected that way. And video is unique in that ability.
Yeah, I remember doing that when I was working at Google. You know, I'd have a little Tandberg next to my monitor, and it would just be open all day to, you know, an engineer I was working with who was in another building, although we were on the same campus. And it was just, you know, great to be able to see when, oh, he's at his desk, oh, he's away somewhere, he's probably at lunch right now. You know, it's actually really, really nice for getting a sense of, you know, what somebody's doing. And it's much easier to actually ping them on IM. And you know, just have, like, we'd have IM conversation, which kind of sounds ridiculous because there we have, you know, a Tandberg next to us. But it was actually really, really pleasant. It's a good way to co-work with somebody.
So we haven't gone that much farther than the first internet sites that showed the coffee pot, you know, whether it was full or empty, or the ones that were focused on the horse, you know, about to give birth or whatever, you know, from 1994.
Mm-hmm.
The Moy Bridge film, mobility,
from 1901.
But still people are, I think a lot of people don't want to be on video, but the mobility will give them an entry point into it, an accessibility into it. And by the way, I'm not meeting phobic, I'm meeting anthropic.
Okay, explain. What does anthropic mean?
Like, you know, I hate them.
Oh. You're not afraid of them, you just
very
really
strict agendas,
them.
And they end on time, they start on time, because I, of course, am in the corporate world. We have a lot of meetings. I have to go to a lot of meetings. But I make my, I make that personality quirk very clear to everybody, so they don't expect me at every meeting.
Okay, well, I'm glad we cleared that up.
Can I throw out another thought out there? Just
please.
One of the things that, like, I actually don't think video fits the very, very small mobile devices as well as it does tablets, which sort of are around when people are kind of fixed and seated, and you know they have that space for doing something. So I'm really curious what's going to happen when we get a camera and an iPad. You know, whether people are actually going to start having a lot more FaceTime calls over the iPad than they actually are on their iPhones.
I would have thought that was true, and I also want to take care of this discussing Ev Williams' move. It's not Ev Williams. Ev Williams is doing exactly what he's always done. It's that Dick Costolo has taken over, running the trains on time. As they move into an advertising environment, Dick is a master at that, and understanding how you tease data or money from data. Does anybody have any other comments on that, and then I can get back to what's interesting?
No, the interesting thing is Dick's challenge is that he's got to decide whether he wants to keep his developers or not, because they've been sort of gradually edging away from they threw a huge developer conference in March, and now they've done a huge amount to alienate them. So the question is, how much he wants to maintain that, and how much they want to take inside, and that's his big decision he's got to make, which is a better one for him to make than for Ev, I think.
Right. Well, but Ev's made it very clear that he's going to throw developers under the bus, has from the beginning, and will continue to.
It was not from the beginning. This is a transition in the last 6 months.
Right. Track will be back any minute now.
I have it.
Putting on Chirp in May was a major commitment to supporting developers, and now they're saying, oh, everyone's coming to the website. They've chucked all the links to the apps off the front page of Twitter.
Google, it's quite significant. Google was going to sell that phone on the website. What happened to that? I mean, people make, they change. They try things that doesn't work, and they move on. But the general tone of Twitter's relationships with developers, I think, was well-defined at Bear Hug Camp back in 1943 when they basically said, screw them. You know, you can do it, play, have fun, just as long as you understand that when we see anybody making money, we're going to take their business and we're going to incorporate it into our product. I mean,
the effect that had, by the way, Steve, back at Bear Hug Camp was, which I was following over a live video feed, just as a side remark, was that developers thought, oh, great, we'll get acquired by Twitter if we build something that's actually scalable and makes money. To a motivation for people to actually develop apps for Twitter, I would claim.
Well, I agree with you. The iPad app, I think they bought somebody and then who was fairly well along and then just incorporated that into their own stuff. The same thing with the iPhone app, right?
Yeah, that was Lauren Brixter of Tweety.
Yeah. So, right. But as I've had this conversation with Nick Halstead at Disrupt, he seems confident that that he's going to have a stream available for his track feed, and I wouldn't be confident of that in a million years. I don't see why anybody would look at the dynamics of how Twitter has dealt with. Maybe it's just their messaging, but I think that retreating from we can't serve it because we're crashing all the time to various excuses, and then finally coming up with we just sold that stream to Microsoft for a certain amount of money for an undisclosed amount of usage, and the same thing with Google. I mean, eventually you start it's very hard to construct any kind of rationale whatsoever for any of this sort of delay and obfuscation, except that they feel that this is the crown jewels of the company and they don't want to let it go. And at the same time, if they don't let it go on some level, then they don't have anything and they don't have a third-party developer community, and then they're screwed. And Facebook, who, if you had put a bet on it a couple of years ago, they were, in the early days when Dave Morin was basically being sent out to explain away the various, impossibilities of Facebook Connect, the first one version, and all that kind of stuff. They've actually succeeded in establishing, if not a happy developer community, certainly one that's viral enough and profitable enough, like Zynga, to be able to build a tremendous platform which is accelerating their adoption. So it just seems strange to me that Facebook, which seemed to be the closed system, is now actually much more open in terms of developers.
Well, I think, they've gone further through the hump towards being a platform. That was something that was fairly clear this week, in that they're over the, okay, we're big enough now that probably we're not going to get killed by our competitors. We can afford to be a bit more magnanimous about it, and Twitter is just going into that tunnel. And I think they need to try and pull themselves out of that again and get to the place, the other side, that Microsoft and Google and Yahoo and Facebook are getting to, which is, oh, right, we'll give you platforms to build stuff, and we're not going to intentionally sit on you and make it hard for you. We're going to try and make it helpful for you. And Twitter is still on the edge there. Some of the sort of noise coming back from them about how things should work, it still has that very much that mindset of, well, obviously we're the center of the universe, and you've got to jump through our hoops. And that sort of, there's a bit more, bit less of that hubris coming from Facebook now. Not a lot less, but a bit less.
So, Robert, can you explain to me why groups are important now? I'm just giving you the chance to do this, early, like I gave you with lists. Now that lists are broken, and
lists aren't broken. They actually work great. I keep using them every single day. But I know you don't get any value out of any of this new stuff. But that's cool.
Well, I got a lot of value out of the 7,000 man technology, genius group that you put me in. I've heard from, you know, it's like a list of everybody that has either fired me or hired me for the past 45
years.
That's
why I invited you in, you know, to taunt you.
Jim Lauterbach says.
So here's the value of groups. We've friended too many idiots, like Jason and Mike Arrington friended this idiot who put him on the NAMBLA group. You know, that tells you you've friended too many idiots, like I friended this guy. And
timing is everything.
This is why I didn't friend you, Robert. Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know, you kicked me off the friend list. You know, so I can't do this to you. But now that we have our friend list is a mess, and it's a mixture of people we know from work, and a mixture of people we know from home, and some family friends, and some distant family friends, and some people we met in elementary school. We don't have any control of that newsfeed anymore, and this gives us the ability to put some control back onto that newsfeed and say,
right, by
hey, these are my
permanently barring everybody that you don't like from being part of this. It's just basically
no, not true at all. In fact, all of my groups except for my family group are open to the public, and anybody who is on them and invited on them can invite anybody else.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. I think I've got 7,000 emails from that group.
This is going to teach everybody how to write Gmail filters.
Exactly. I mean, this is the Buzz floor again, which is that anything Scoble touches fills your inbox with spam, and it's the same problem we have here. And it's what it's going to do is it's going to mean that people who have, you know, Twitter has a better stability model when you have a lot of followers. It doesn't actually cause them all to be flooded by each other's stuff. You know,
To be fair, there's a couple of constraints on groups. First, if the group goes over 250 people, like one of my lists does, the email notifications automatically gets turned off, so you don't get notifications from a group that gets super big. The second thing is, if you're getting notifications from a group, you can go to that group and either say I don't want to be part of this group because it's an idiotic group, or two, you can click edit notifications right on the top right and say don't send me anything from this group into my email, or you could do like what I did and just set a Gmail rule, a Gmail filter.
Is that the basic affordance is now driving you away from having noisy friends and back towards having small friends, which may be, you know, a design thing in Facebook. They've always said they want to construct your real social graph, not your sort of publicly
performed
graph.
Right, they're doing the same thing they did with translation. They're just letting the audience fix the social graph for them.
I'd like to hear you sort of Yuri's take on this, if he's still there.
No, he's choked. His bandwidth is choked with
email notifications. Never really worked with any platform that I've used in the past. Like really, really never worked because it was too big of a hassle to maintain them and set them up. But I think Facebook's at the point where they're at the scale where pretty much everyone in the world is on Facebook. And it seems like that's what you needed in order to actually make groups like a necessity for, being able to use. Nobody can really, despite, you know, attempts, it's very difficult to actually quit Facebook because just so much, you know, social inertia is taking place there. So how do you make Facebook usable when you have, like, you know, this constant stream of, you know, essentially half spam or real spam coming at you through the social network? So I think in that sense, you know, groups are like probably the most welcomed, like more, even more than places, kind of a well functioning part of Facebook. The problem, you know, clearly what Kevin just pointed out is like, well, groups get spammy too pretty quickly. How can you ever get out of that? I don't think you can, frankly. The only way you can do that is by you know, keeping on chopping it down into subgroups as you go. And I don't know, like, if Scoble's got some secret, like, top technologists group already in the works where, you know, you only have the people who actually, you know, are the most interesting ones. But that's generally what tends to happen is you just get, you know, people chopping the big groups down into smaller groups. You know, if you guys remember, there was this service called A Small World that ended up, like, being an invite only for, the sort of high flyers of the world, and they ended up having to, you know, split it into something they called the Big World and the Real Small World when they got too many people on.
Well, I just...
You guys remember that?
Yes. You know, it's the Woody Allen joke about, you know, I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have me.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the other thing I find interesting about Robert's group is that a very interesting group of people post one thing, which is, well, this looks, I'm really looking forward to this interesting conversation, and then nothing forever more, because you know, they're immediately trying to figure out how to turn the damn thing off because there's so many email notifications. I mean, let's just say it's immature.
You know, 1989.
Zuckerberg, to his defense, said that this feature was not made for large groups. They didn't want it to be used for the kinds of groups that I immediately tried to build. Right?
Yeah,
they
and Twitter said that track. You know, groups. Twitter didn't said this wasn't a communications platform, and that they did, you know, track was not available because that's not what they wanted you to do with it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, these internet technologies have a habit of bending to the will of the user, not the designer. You know. The designer gets one shot at the beginning.
Right.
And then everybody else designs it from that point on.
Well, I mean, the other half of this is that, you know, the conversation, you know, Yuri and I had this last week about on TunnelVision about the idea of tunneling, about the idea of you can manage large groups if you've got someone there who's setting the tone and making sure the conversation keeps going. We all have experience of mailing lists and groups that do work well on a large scale because there's someone there setting the tone and keeping it there. And that may be how things work out.
But the problem I've always had with mailing lists, etc., is that it immediately develops this hierarchy of explainers and people who are managing and people who like everybody to talk and people who only want to have a certain elite group talking. And you get this management nightmare that eventually collapses and burns. So, the blogs came...
It doesn't always, but it takes some skill to keep it going, it's true.
Yeah, or right. it takes a different kind of technology, like blogs that came along and fundamentally transformed that, or the stream, which allows you to be able to apply a certain kind of social dynamic, and social not in the sense of let's go down to the water cooler, but more social in terms of what the dynamics are of a project or of an event or some sort of guiding principle that we serve in order to get value out of the environment.
Well, isn't that why Quora and Stack Overflow are brilliant? Because they focus on the conversation rather than the group?
Well, I don't know. I've never used either.
Yeah, so Stack Overflow is mostly for developers. And
well, they're starting to fork Stack Overflow into other communities, but they... what they're trying to do is build affordances there that encourage people to take up this tumbling role, I think, so that they've got, you know, they've got a certain amount of badges and points, and if you get enough points, you start getting the ability to organize posts and edit other people's posts and do things like that. So they've built this sort of, it's not quite Slashdot-like, but almost, I think it's slightly better structured than the Slashdot model of... If you answer questions and people upvote your questions, that gives you slightly more authority in the group, and that means you can then become a gardener of the questions in that group and so on. So they're trying to build infrastructure in Stack Overflow to do that. And I think that's definitely an interesting approach to this.
All right, well...
But aren't both Quora and Stack Overflow Q&A services fundamentally? And Facebook's got Facebook questions.
Yeah, I think, again...
It's kind of like comparing apples to oranges.
Well, I think that when you say something is something fundamentally... these things have a beginning and perhaps a middle, and that is reflective. It's like startups, where they start on one rationale, and then almost immediately, in order to get more money, they have to decide how they're going to make enough money to be able to get to the next stage, and things start to change, and they morph. So... again, I don't know about Quora, but Mike Arrington in this group that Robert formed said, you know, an interesting thing. I know where he's coming from. He's talking about FriendFeed, I think, basically. He says that he just doesn't like to have comments pooled, to have his content being pooled on a third-party platform. You know, obviously, when you can sell your own platform for $40 million or whatever it was, it certainly makes a lot of sense to view the world that way. But from a usage perspective, I find the value of people interactively interacting and collaborating on these third-party platforms to be compelling.
Yeah.
So there's a struggle and a push-pull there. But as to Quora being a Q&A site, I think it may start that way, but I think that it will immediately move toward this middle ground where the intentions of the site give way to the effects of what happens on the site. And since I promised several people that we would wrap this early, I have a feeling
so
we'll be talking more about this. But I'll give everybody a shot at just summing up. John, you want to say anything?
Yeah, I'll end on groups. Groups are a great way of filtering and collecting a set of content and a certain kind of not intuitive or corporate knowledge or whatever the social graph knowledge is. To start a group effectively, it's not just inviting people, but to actually have a mission, and maybe that mission morphs over time, but just to, like, why are these people gathered together, and what are they trying to accomplish? I think that's we'll learn this behavior, and Facebook groups will teach it to us, because all the other group services like Google Groups hasn't taught it to us, Yahoo Groups hasn't taught it to us, but I think Facebook has a shot at it.
Okay, I agree with you. I'm going to leave Scoble for last so he can get on his tricycle. Yuri, last thoughts?
Yeah, last thought for me is going to be that I think over and over again we've seen one of the reasons groups don't work in the end is because they're too static. It's because people want to actually come together on a more dynamic basis, sort of more like peer-to-peer ad hoc social networks. My dad, who's a social theorist, calls them knots instead of groups or teams. It's like knots with a K that just kind of come together on an as-needed basis and disperse once, you know, whatever problem these people have come together to solve, you know, gets resolved in some way. And I think the challenge for us building technology is to make technology and structure that is so adaptive that it can be, you know, almost instantaneously created, and, you know, once that conversation is over, it just, you know, disappears. And I think that's the challenge with groups, because groups are much more static things that, you know, just kind of tend to become these dinosaurs over time.
Kevin?
I think, you know, we're still trying to make sense of this. I mean, and it is this uneasy balance between anthropology, sociology, and tech that we're trying to understand here. And what we've got is lots of iterations of rules in different products that then end up giving slightly different shapes to the environment. But also, it's very much shaped by the people who join and what they do there. And it's not always clear which is seeding which. You know, how much of Quora's success is that they've seeded a bunch of Valley people who like talking about themselves, and then they have a bunch of questions about startups, and it works if you care about that stuff. Doesn't really work for anything else. How much of Stack Overflow is that they've done a really good job of seeding it around particular technologies so they can attract the things, because we are all frustrated with the way mailingless work. So. I'm still intrigued by this, and I still think that we've got a long way to go on this. And watching the differences between how group interactions and sort of mass conversation happens on Twitter and how it's happening on Facebook and Buzz is really instructive in this, because they are like sort of controlled experiments in different worlds.
Okay, Robert, last words.
That's Rob Legess that you always thank at the end of the show.
I'm about to, so you can keep
start him. Driving around the Rackspace with my go-kart.
Okay. I want to thank Rackspace, and particularly the guy you just saw, Rob Legess, without whom this would have not gotten back on the air. And same thing for New Tech and their TriCaster, without which this wouldn't be on video. I want to say our daughters lost a friend in their school community this weekend due to a head injury sustained in a soccer game, and our hearts are breaking. And you know, I lost a brother and a sister at very young ages, so I know how they feel, but I think we all know how devastating these kinds of things can be to especially the parents. So, you know, go home and hug your kids a little extra today, and let's use this kind of event as a way of reminding ourselves how precious life is and how much we appreciate everybody who comes on the show and in the chat room and pays attention and doesn't pay attention. We don't care. Just thank you for being here. This is Steve Gilmore. This has been the Gilmore Gang. We'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.